Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast where we review audiobooks and also regular books, because that's how that works. So, what did we read this week?
The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin.
In which we learned that darkness is left-handed. Who narrated it?
I object to that.
George Goodall.
Okay. What does it say on the back of the audiobook?
Written in 1969. A groundbreaking work of science fiction. The Left Hand of Darkness tells the story of a lone human emissary to Winter, an alien world whose inhabitants can change their gender. His goal is to facilitate Winter's inclusion in a growing intergalactic civilization, but to do so, he must bridge the gulf between his own views and those of the completely dissimilar culture that he encounters, embracing the aspects of psychology, society, and human emotion on an alien world. The Left Hand of Darkness stands as a landmark achievement in the annals of intellectual science fiction.
All right. Well, let's see. So I first read this book back in high school. It was actually assigned summer reading, and it was the first time that I was just like, whoa, they think that science fiction can be like literature? I mean, really? I think that some of it went over my head. There's an introduction from the author where she basically says, this is what I'm trying to do in this book. I'm trying to say that human beings are not entirely defined by their gender. I'm massively paraphrasing and probably like mischaracterizing here.
That's all right. Someone will be outraged.
They'd have to listen first. They've fallen into my little trap.
Come and listen to this and be mad.
Exactly. I think that the writing is amazing. And I think that one thing that one should bear in mind is it's really written sort of as a travelogue. It starts out as kind of first the main character visits one place on this strange alien world, and then he visits another place, and then there's sort of a long description of the Iditarod, then the book ends. I mean, it's not that the book has no plot. There's definitely things happening, but there isn't sort of your classic thriller plot, and that's to its credit.
I mean, and even apparently, you know, they would have the segues into the Hearth stories where they would give some historical parable or something, and like you said, it was interspersed with sort of his journal, and you know, that was very non-traditional structure, you know, 1969,
right?
And you know, to the point that, you know, I read an interview where Le Guin was basically saying like, well, you know, when I got stuck about how the story should go, you know, I would find myself essentially writing these, you know, Hearth stories, and that would sort of help me understand the world better and kind of how it actually would go in this world. And at first she wasn't even going to put them in. And then she kind of said, well, you know, it helped me write the story. Maybe it would help them understand the story as well. And, you know, so that's kind of how they ended up in there. But she's like, at the time, that was, you know, most, you know, science fiction was, you know, beginning, middle, end. There wasn't like, you know, these kind of, you know, things that would happen, you know, that were not more.
Right. And it's sort of amusing that it no longer really stands out, because I think this was so influential that now that kind of aside of, and this is another look at the culture, is now very normal.
Right. And, you know, even the stuff about, you know, gender fluidity and, you know, where everyone's essentially, you know, a neutral gender until they go into Kemmer once a month. And, you know, at the time that was definitely a groundbreaking thing. And now it seems like we read plenty of books where, you know, not exactly like that, but it's not like, an unheard of concept to have, you know, characters who are gender fluid or in a whole planet that something unusual is happening, right, compared to Earth, right? And so in a way, like you said, it kind of like, you know, perhaps shows the evolution of what's happened in fiction, or just the fact that it was so groundbreaking that now it doesn't feel as groundbreaking from now.
Yeah, I'd refrain from, you know, saying the book is dated, but it is a sort of certainly a first of its kind. You know, not dated in terms of like, you know, technology or verbiage or anything, but, you know, right now we kind of take for granted, you know, this ability to be, you know, gender fluid, if that's the way you want to put it, or the possibility that there could be genderless planets, or that people are, you know, just moving back and forth as needed.
Right. Although,
you know,
it's
like in today's book, it would be, you know, just like a two or three page, you know, element.
Sure.
You know, and this is what this entire, you know, a lot of this book is about, how society would have evolved differently. So I really enjoyed the book.
Great.
It was very thought provoking, made me think a lot about stuff.
Good.
But I think much like the both of you, I listened to it several times and kind of still left with, well, that happened.
Well, it definitely feels like,
I mean, I feel like I don't feel like I wasted my time.
No,
I mean,
it was great.
I mean, it was well written and, you know, I'm not sure what more opinion I'm supposed to come away with it, I guess, is my problem. I mean, it's a great world setting to me, right? I mean, there's a lot of world building, you know, and like, you know, Kevin was saying, there's two other books that are in this, in the Hainish cycle.
Mm-hmm. Our stories.
And I don't even think that they have like a specified reading order. Like this sort of exist as, you know, free floating books and you could listen to them in any order.
And I think that they're basically just in the same world setting, right? I mean, it's not like every other book these days talks about fluid gendered people. It's still not a standard trope. Like, it's still considered...
But I guess what I meant to say was that it's not as surprising.
Sure, absolutely.
I think that, you know, when this book came out in 1969, you know, people kind of sat up and like took notice just because it was so different, the topic.
Yeah, but I'm sort of thinking about the fact that just a couple of years ago or last year, we had Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, where everyone was referred to as she, and that had a bit of controversy associated with it.
Yeah. I guess we've come a long way in some ways and not so much in another way.
Yes. Before we make more not necessarily well thought out political statements, I think it's time for us to be dragged away by the secret police and put to work on a voluntary farm.
I want to take a sledge across the ice shelf.
It's that voluntary. That can be arranged.
Voluntary.
All right. Well, we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion. We should mention that one of the reasons that we scheduled this now is because Ursula K. Le Guin died in January of 2018, pretty soon before we actually are recording this.
Right. It was kind of like we had actually had a plan maybe a month from now, and then that happened. And then it's just like, I don't know how else to deal with this. So I have to read some stuff that she wrote. Well,
I mean, of course, you dealt with it in the proper way by having a phone conversation with Neil Gaiman in your dreams.
Yes. Neil Gaiman was kind enough to call me
in your dreams.
In my dreams. Yes. And talk about, you know, how difficult it was that she had died. And, you know, I'd been reading a lot of like tweets that he had put up about how, you know, just what a great influence she had been on him and all this stuff. And, you know, I was reading a lot of articles, you know, about all these different authors saying how much of an influence and just that kind of stuff. And you know, I'd liked her work a lot, obviously, in the past. I've read most of it. And this was one of the few books I actually hadn't read for whatever reason. I think because there hadn't been an Audible edition until fairly recently. And most of my reading has been audio for the past few years for time constraint reasons. But it was very strange because it kind of hit me a lot harder than I would have expected it to. So my response was, I read about four of her books in the last couple weeks. And like, you know, what was it called? The Ones Who Walk Away from Omalaz and a couple other short stories. And, you know, kind of ones that were considered some of her more famous works.
Okay. Yeah. So we failed to mention at the top that this won both the Nebula and the Hugo Awards. Oh, by the way, lest I forget, if you're this far in the podcast, you're still listening. And if you're not, then I am communicating with you directly in your mind. the Hugo nominations are currently open at time of deployment of this podcast. And if you are a Hugo member or wish to become one, you can nominate your favorite podcast, and you can also nominate this one for...
Of course, those are the same, right?
Of course. For the best fan cast category. Completely off-the-cuff plug there. Anyway, so yes, this was all kinds of award-winning. So one of the things we wanted to discuss was the concept of Schiffgräther, which is one of the many bizarre names that stuck with me, you know, when we when we proposed talking about this, suddenly, you know, it's just like, Schiffgrether, it's from a world meaning shadow, pops into my head. Thank you, brain. Where's my phone? I don't know.
Schiffgrether, the rando fact of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Or more like the week for us.
Exactly. Well, yeah. It was one of those things where I think it had about the right amount in it, but I still kind of wanted either, you know, I wanted more in terms
of an explicit definition,
right? Or, you know, more examples of it in the book, because I couldn't tell when somebody was acting according to Schiffgrether or whether they were just sort of being pigheaded or something like that.
I mean, I think part of the point was that they were saying this happens between cultures, right? That there's things that don't easily translate.
Right.
This seems like one of those words that doesn't translate well into other languages, just because it's encompasses much more than just a book definition, so to speak.
Yes. Like fuckface, as we were saying earlier.
Yes. I wasn't going to say it, but now that you brought it up.
We do have the explicit tag. We got to use it every once in a while or else I have to pay a dollar.
Yes. I mean, in the book, they say prestige, face, place, the pride relationship, the untranslatable and all-important principle of social authority in Karhide and all civilizations in Gethin. And then later it derives from an old Gethinian word for shadow. And that was interesting too, because they, you know, shadow, well, not only being a, you know, kind of a major symbolic piece of, you know, this and like Wizard of Earthsea and other things, right? But maybe in different ways, I think, because here it seems to me that, you know, kind of like shadow is kind of like maybe like is kind of like a symbolic of like what do you cast on the world, mm-hmm. in a sense, like, you know, how big of a shadow, you know, do you cast? And so they talk about like the group that was the people who predicted the future, right? Mm-hmm. They were at this fastness, which, you know, is kind of like a
monastery
or something. So when they're there, they hold no social status, but one of them said, well, if I were to leave, I would take back my status and my shadow. Mm-hmm. And later on, they mention about, you know, the king may not change your shadow, but he may try, right. And you know may make it shorter or longer and stuff. So it does seem, you know, this concept of, you know, how much influence do you have in the world or something.
Well, I did hear a lot that Le Guin is very influenced by Taoism, and that a lot of the light-dark duality is somewhat the yin and yang of Taoism. I don't know enough about Taoism to really comment remotely intelligently about that. But I thought I'd mention it to sound smarter.
Well, it totally worked. It was mentioned explicitly in the book at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know any more than sort of like the basics of it, and we wouldn't be able to comment intelligently either. But
right.
But it's cool.
Yeah, they got this awesome symbol.
Yeah, Taoism is another thing I read a little too early and went completely over my head. I had this whole idea that Taoism was like the Force in Star Wars. not necessarily smart.
Well, they do have a book with, you know, Pooh and Piglet that explain it all, right?
Yes.
That's true.
That one I've read. But anyway.
And yet I still don't know anything more to say intelligently about it.
I just got my head stuck in this honeypot.
Oh, bother.
But
indeed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complex concept, and there is an entire other novel that could be written that just explores Schiffgrether, because like the little bits that we get of it where Estravan, who is Mr. A's sort of local contact, sort of opposite number, quasi, you know, like unresolved sexual tension partner, that sort of thing.
Kirk and Spock?
Yeah, kind of. Well, different kind of dualities, I think. But he's
more the sexual tension.
Sure. He's very much more involved in Schiffgrether. In fact, he's supposed to be like this incredible adept at it. And his ex-lover stops by to talk to Genli after he gets exiled at some point. And we get sort of a little glimpse of what Schiffgrether in action is supposed to be when the lover says, oh, well, do you know Estravan? And it's just like, of course he knows Estravan, but in terms of Schiffgrether, this is a move in Schiffgrether, and his response normally would be something like, oh, I don't know, could you describe him? And
he just sort of fed up, and he's like, yes, I do.
Yeah,
and then the guy's like, oh, okay.
You mean you know him like in a biblical sense?
Right. And it's actually kind of, You know, I mean, for half the book, I just kind of kept inserting like Klingon honor concept. Like it kept, it's kind of like a word that, you know, you would expect to be in Klingon or something like Shifgrathar, except, except not quite as harsh on this, on this planet, you know?
I mean, it's like the, it's like a societal cultural machismo, or, you know, in Japan where they have a strict sense of honor, you know, and
but it
other cultures have this to varying degrees, right? And those are just a couple of examples.
Well, that was the thing that kind of messed up, you know, a lot of the dialogue and in between Genly and Estevan, where they, you know, Genly eyes here to kind of, you know, say, hey, do you want to join the Ecumen? It's cool, you know, lots of planets and stuff. And because of Shifgrathar, like, you know, you can't ask questions. You can't really suggest things to other people because that like impugns in some direction their Shifgrathar and,
right.
And Genly, it's like, it goes, you know, I know it would go one way or the other. I'm not sure which way, you know, but I know it would do something that, you know, they don't want. So right before Estevan is sort of like kicked out of the country as a traitor, he, you know, he has dinner with Genly, and he tries to, as directly as he can in his culture, say, well, by the way, you know, this and that, you should do this, you know, you're out of favor, you know, bad things might happen. But he's like very, you know, walking, you know, circuitously around what's actually saying it without actually saying it directly.
In which, and he probably thought he was being pretty blunt about
That's what he was frustrated with, because he thought he was being as blunt as he possibly could. It's like shouting at someone in all caps, right? and the other guy just, you know, Genly just doesn't get it. And he's like, I wish you would just tell me, you know, and he's like, what? Okay. And
I am.
You know, it takes till these, you know, towards the end of the book where that, you know, they kind of surpass that. But, you know, it's kind of interesting too. I read, you know, as part of this, since it was in the same world, I had Coming of Age in Carhide, which was, you know,
a little bit more graphic in some ways.
Well, right. A true coming of age story, someone going into camera for the first time. But the part of it was, as far as Shifgrathar, the, you know, this child is what, approaching 16 or what, I don't remember, you know, roughly whatever age that is. And they're, and the parents of the child basically give something called like the last advice, you know, in the culture, which is like, well, when you become, you know, when you go into Kemmer, you become an adult and you gain Shifgrathar. And so at that point, it's rude to give you advice. So before that happens, you know, all of the family members like give sort of like, you know, it's like the talk before they get married or something, where it's like, okay, now do this and that or whatever, you know, it's like, you know, or before you go off to college.
Kind of terrifying.
Like the idea of Shifgrathar right at this point. It's just like, oh, so then my parents couldn't give me advice.
Right. It would be rude. You know, they could walk around it and kind of point at it verbally,
You know,
and you could not get it.
By the way, my parents give great advice, just in case they're listening.
So anyway, yeah, it's, and like you said, the definitions is sort of walked around too. And maybe because the point is, you know, we don't exactly know how to define it. So we just sort of point the general direction of what it might be.
Well, you know, the problem is that if you go into it much more than what she already does, then the whole novel's about it, which was not her goal, I don't think.
Right.
And it would completely overshadow the themes she was actually going for. So it's one of these good kinds of wanting more. I would be really interested in reading the possibly excruciating novel that's all about Shifgrathar.
You know, the young Kemmer, you know, whatever guide to Shifgrathar.
Something like that. It's just like, oh, and never say that you actually know somebody. That would be rude.
Kevin's secretly pining for like a stat block or something for Kemmer or for Shifgrathar. And
it's actually
a resource book in the D&D universe.
It's the Dear Abby, you know,
now thinking Shifgrathar about it, thing. Yeah, perhaps like, you know, Shifgrathar is like listening to Kevin when somebody asks him exactly how long a particular software project is going to take.
That's like committing ritual suicide.
There is no exact answer for that. It's like a probability distribution.
Exactly. That's the sort of answer he gives, ladies and gentlemen.
God, my life feels like a misshapen probability distribution.
That's because you hang around with us. One of the things that was sort of odd about the book was that quite you know, as we described earlier, according to the standards of the time, Le Guin used he as the pronoun everywhere, which sort of made me kind of cast the characters a little bit towards male in my mind's eye. Do you think, you know, if it were written nowadays, that they would have chosen a different pronoun scheme?
Well, I mean,
yeah, I definitely think they would have chosen some more modern, she would have chosen some more modern, you know, gender pronouns maybe, but yeah, I was going to say something else. But
that was short.
Right. It's like, you know, well, like the other book, you know, it could be she or it could be alternating or they, you know, the problem is English doesn't have that unless you say one for everything. And
right. Which would really take you out of the narrative. So, I mean, she made the correct choice for 1969. I don't know if it's still the correct choice for 2018 or whatever bloody year this is.
Well, right. I mean, at the time, this was already sort of a, you know, a risky novel.
Right.
You know, you're trying to get something published. And at the time, you know, she, in an interview, she has basically said like, well, I really thought that this would be something that, you know, maybe would get completely rejected by the science fiction community as, you know, just something they weren't into or just like uncomfortable with. And she kind of said that didn't really happen. You know, kind of oddly enough, she got more pushback from feminists at the time saying that she didn't go far enough, that like, you know, the protagonist from Earth was male and not female.
But and she actually was able to make more points with that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, she said at the time she had considered that also. And that would have been even riskier, but you know, she ended up just doing this. And yeah, I think it's not like it doesn't stand, like you said, in different ways. And in a sense, you know, I mean, obviously I'm biased. I'm, you know, I'm male. At least I think of myself as male. So it's just like, okay.
What day is today?
Yes. And so I don't know. Obviously everyone comes with their own bias to something. And I think, I don't know. I think now maybe we come with less bias or less, you know, consciously try to come to something with less bias rather than implicit less bias.
Less, you know, unconscious bias.
Right.
Well,
as opposed to conscious bias, right?
Sure. I mean, we now have partially, you know, thanks to books like this, for example, we have more terms to deal with this sort of thing. And I think that if she had sort of said, oh, and everything shall be Z, you know, that's right. Not going to get published.
Yeah. And she, in her novels with her words that she uses, you know, that's, you know, she had said that that was a very, you know, central part of the book, that she couldn't write the book and just put Glorb as like, you know, someone's name or whatever. Sure. It's like, it has to fit, you know, in the world and kind of in her head as like, this word works for this somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, in sort of more than just a, because, you know, apparently there were definitely, you know, science fiction books where you go to another planet and it's like, you know, you have this string of unpronounceable, you know, characters, which isn't inherently bad, but it can take you out of the story.
Right.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking, is that, you know, if she had used some sort of, you know, artificial word to represent both genders or non-gender, you know, it might have been discontinuous to the reader or real listener and more difficult to follow the story, sort of taking you out of the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I think when I was a kid, I don't use it. You know, we were talking before that, you know, it's like I don't write many essays now, so that I don't really have the opportunity to see what I would do. But, you know, when I was younger, my natural inclination was to use they, you know, for ungendered pronoun. And then they would say, that's wrong. That's the wrong, you know, it's like, you're like, okay, it's not singular. You can't do that. And you're like, well, why? It just seems like the natural one at the time anyway.
Right. It's one of those things where it's what we use in casual speech. It has this weird side effect of using plural nouns for singular people, but whatever.
Well, I mean, it's also the way that some languages are just constructed, right? You know, they have a, you know, we have a collective group of, you know, mixed gendered people, right? You know, in Latin derived languages, you use the masculine form to refer to that group of people, right?
Sure. And also, like, at least in English, we don't have to have the gender of every single word.
Yeah, we just have a confusing hodgepodge of rules.
Yeah, languages are terrible. We should just, you know, use Lojban.
Good idea. That would be the obvious solution.
Have to write an entire essay on how to construct a single sentence.
Or Esperanto or something glorious.
Yes.
Is Esperanto gendered? I can't remember.
I don't remember either.
I don't think so. And I mean, they simplified as much as they possibly could. So if it's gender, there's only one. Now, I'm pretty sure they don't.
It's you and y'all.
For a very short time, I did try to learn Esperanto, like in high school.
Naturally.
I in the newspaper, there was this thing where it's like, learn Esperanto. You could join the Esperanto group of the Bay Area or whatever. And I just wrote in and said, yes, I want to join. And for like 20 years after that, I would get handwritten letters in Esperanto from like people who are really, really into Esperanto. And, you know, a part of the group, and it was, you know, it was sort of like supposed to encourage you to try to translate it. And I kind of felt bad after a while because I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore and I don't know Esperanto, but
yeah, we didn't want to tell you, but they elected you president in absentia a little while ago.
Yay!
You're giving a speech tomorrow in Esperanto. Yeah,
that's right.
And no teletype machine or no,
teleprompter.
Anyway, yes, as essential as this is to the nature of this book, discussion of the book,
yes,
there were a lot of sort of outtakes to previous anthropological surveys of the planet, and they talked a lot about that this society was less warlike, partially they thought because of the less gendered nature of it, because, you know, there weren't necessarily men out to prove how manly they were.
Right.
What did you guys think of that?
I mean, you know, it would be an interesting experiment if you could actually run it. But I mean, I think it was an interesting concept to say, like, okay, well, if, you know, I don't know if it's you know, men are naturally that way, but that's definitely can seem true in many cases. And they talk about that as a central thing in the book as well, where Genly definitely, you know, has a very 60s male view, and he's kind of like, you know, talking about Estevan is saying, like, well, you know, he seemed very feminine with the way he was doing certain things and, like, you know, very pliable or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, kind of looking down, it seemed like, and he was getting mad at one point when they were doing their sledge journey where it's, you know, he was like, I can keep up. Why do you say I can't keep up? He's like, I'm stronger than you. God damn it. And like, he was like, kind of like muttering to himself, you know, kind of in his head.
Well, and then Estevan was saying, you know, this guy, he's super strong in some ways, like he can lift this whole sledge, but, you know, he's like really fragile in other ways.
Cause yeah, he's, you know, just not as durable.
Like, right.
You know, his ego is very fragile and he'll just like kind of go off and be like, damn it. I mean, I think it made its point that, but then the other thing was that they kind of said it seemed like it wasn't completely impossible because Tybe, you know, kind of the guy who took over after Estevan as the prime minister, you know, under the king, seemed to kind of be pushing towards a war.
Right.
And it wasn't very explicit, but he kept, you know, there was this kind of disputed land and he kept kind of doing things and, you know, encouraging, you know, oh, these brave people on the border that ran over and killed a bunch of borders in the other country, you know, sure, they're very patriotic and awesome. And
the one place seemed, it was a monarchy. And then the other seemed very Soviet to me.
Yeah. Yeah. The one,
there's Karhide, Orgarin. Yeah. Karhide and Orgarin.
Yeah. And Orgarin was very, you know, like you said, very USSR, which makes sense in 1969. And I wouldn't say it felt super like the US, but it was very, you know, there's like a king. So I don't know, it's supposed to be like England or something. I don't know. It was kind of a generic,
right.
A generic thing, but,
I think it was a fictional place on another planet.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Oh, that's the problem.
But
now I understand why Kevin looked so confused for a moment.
God. But I think that, I mean, there were portions of it that sort of seemed kind of American, like the jingoism and the ability to just sort of like rile people up and right, that sort of thing. But on the other hand, it was very sort of like, you know, French court type of, you know, and then this person is actually in charge, although the king is this person and the king is crazy. And
it was very like European monarchy.
Right. You're right. It does sound like French historical monarchy, like, you know, King Louis the whatever. And like, you know, the king is crazy seems to be the standard thing. Like, oh no, of course he's supposed to be crazy.
It's kind of the job.
he's crazy. He's the king and he's very paranoid. And
exactly. All right. Well, let's see. Our usual questions. Was there tea?
Sort of, yes. As the quote in the book says, tea, it might as well be called Orsh.
Yes, I'm not sure whether it gets more or less points for that.
Yes, well, it was brown. It was kind of Swedish. It was made from some grain. And they basically, it had some kind of stimulant that was supposed to be something that was like in, you know, not in tea, but
in tobacco, I thought you said, or their equivalent of tobacco, or is it
it was like lobelin or something like that, which is some stimulant that's in tobacco, I think.
Okay. Just like coca leaves or something.
But I did like the general, the rough quote was, you know, they were saying, well, you know, in the countries where there was no beer, there was Orsch, you know, the tea. Where there was neither beer nor Orsch, there were no people.
Yes.
So, yes.
And favorite scenes?
I think the sledge ride.
Yeah, definitely.
Was probably one of mine. It was definitely a drastic change of pace for the book.
And it was very vivid. That was something that I enjoyed a lot more on the reread. The first time I was just like, they're still in the goddamn snow.
and yet it didn't drag either, which was sort of the interesting part to me. I mean, it kind of made me think a lot of, you know, like the old man in the sea, right?
Yeah.
It's like a long boat ride, you know, or floating around in the ocean, but they're, you know, it didn't drag out. It wasn't boring.
Exactly. There was always sort of the next step. And it was really interesting how, like, Estevan, as a native to the planet, everybody knows exactly how to calculate precisely how much provisions they're going right. to need, because that's just as natural as, you know, figuring out how to use your phone in this society right now.
I mean, yeah, when you, like, you know, when I go backpacking, that's the kind of thing you do where you're like, okay, it's in winter, so you need this much per person per day, and you calculate it, but, you know, but yeah, I guess he also is like, well, you know, in rest or in movement or whatever, like how much you need. And the funny, you know, that was definitely one of my, or pretty much my favorite part of the book overall was, you know, and like you said, it was very vivid. You know, there were a lot of very specific details of like, and this is exactly how we did this. You know, we set up camp and we, you know, ate our Gitche Michi. And that was actually something that was funny when it, when they, you know, because they talked about Gitche Michi, you know, half a dozen times in the book. And that was sort of like these hyperfood, as it was called. It was like compressed, you know, food cubes. But
that's about as science fiction-y as it gets in some of it.
Right. And so, you know, they say in this one quote was, one cube of Gitche Michi expanded by hot water into a sort of small doughy bun. And that immediately popped in my head was that first early scene in The Force Awakens where Rey gets this little thing and she puts in water and it goes,
boom, one quarter portion.
This little like bluish green bun. And I was like, if that's not a reference to this, it seems like it should be, because like, you know, this is obviously like, you know, like we've said, it's a groundbreaking kind of work. And it seems like it should be a reference to this if it wasn't.
Sure.
Because you know, it's basically exactly what they described.
We're going to make it one.
Yes, it is one now.
This is what you meant now.
So say we all.
So say we all.
So say we all.
Okay. Yeah, let's see. I really like the sledge journey. I also really liked, there's a bit at the end where the normal humans, quote unquote, come down and Genli is just like, okay, they just seemed completely crazy to me, because like they seemed, you know, to him, like they were exaggerated in doing, you know, low voices and high voices. Yeah. It's just like, you know, if suddenly you went outside and everyone was like, hello, rah!
I know, it's like some operatic thing suddenly right. where they come get off the ship and like, hello. And right, I thought I liked that part too. It kind of underlined, you know, the difference, I guess, or, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it kind of shows like he was sort of, I don't want to say degenderized, but, you know, sort of everything now from that point on, you know, based on his last several years of experience are now, you know, heavily influenced by the fact that other Earth people have genders, whereas he's been living in a community that really doesn't for a vast majority of their lives, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's sort of like almost like a culture shock.
Okay. If for some bizarre reason you want to get in contact with us, there are multiple ways of doing it. There is on Twitter, the SF3 podcast.
Number three, not spelled out.
That's true. SF number three podcast, not NUMBERTHREE either.
But I wouldn't put it past us.
No, yes. That would really be annoying. There's also SF3podcast@gmail.com and iTunes. You can search for Sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi. That's SCIFI, repeated three times. Or search for SF3 if you can't find us that way, because we chose a really bad name.
Yeah, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Really did. Really did. So many things do.
First thing that came to our minds.
Yes. All right. Well, I think it's time for us to, I don't know, we don't have a Okay.
Eat some Gitchy Michi.
Yeah, that's great. That's yes. Fantastic.
Well, whatever. Escape from the farm.
Yes, it's time for us to escape from the voluntary farm and start the ice journey that shall comprise the rest of our lives. So, until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.